I'll begin with just a short comment which has to do with my own discipline, the field of anthropology, and say very briefly something which is behind a lot of my comments today. And that is an idea that I have been trying to write about in recent years. And the idea is simply that anthropology, which has many great accomplishments in its history, has by and large, and rather amazingly, avoided or marginalized or sometimes ignored the future as a subject. Anthropology has done remarkable things with custom, tradition, habit, history, memory, all these crucial subjects. But the future has been, for a whole variety of reasons, a kind of minor or sometimes hidden subject in the history of anthropology. And I believe this has had a lot of effects which need some revisiting and some correction. And so today's talk is partly a dialogue with my own discipline. And I'll make only one other comment about this background thought in my mind, namely that one result of a kind of indifference or unconsciousness about the importance of the future, and that too of the future as a cultural fact, and I'm going to stress this today, what does it mean to speak of the future as a cultural fact? One effect of this has been to hand, in a way, the subject of the future over to many other fields, principally in the harder social sciences, such as economics, but also to other more specialized fields in the natural and social sciences, such as, for example, the field of climate studies, which I know you've had occasion to think about in this series. So my hope is that anthropology will, and by anthropology, by the way, I don't mean only anthropology, narrowly speaking, but any inquiry which is concerned with cultural issues should pay some attention to how the future emerges in human societies and human life and how it is shaped, so that we can join the debate about the future rather than mostly complaining about how other fields or disciplines handle the future and how we would do a much better job if we were to do it. I think it'd be good for us to in fact do it or try to do it, and that is part of what I'm trying to do today. So the bulk of my talk will concern what does it mean to treat the future as a cultural fact? And as I discuss this, I will bring up the subject of some of my own research in India on cities, and also conclude with some thoughts about future possibilities in how we can take on the question of the future. So indeed, hope and the future are much of the content of my talk, but also there is a concern about how to take up this engagement in a fuller interdisciplinary way also on my mind. So the argument I wish to make is that there are three kinds of factors or forces in human life that we need to study together in order to conduct a full analysis of the future as a cultural fact. And those three elements are, and I'll speak about each of them for some time, aspiration, which is closely related to hope, imagination, and anticipation. So let me begin then with imagination, and then I'll go on to aspiration and then to anticipation. And that will bring me to some issues in our world today. I have written at some length, particularly in the book that was just mentioned, modernity at large, about the imagination as a social fact. And for those of you who may not have much idea about that book, which was published in 1996, when I was trying to understand, in a way, the world after the fall of the Berlin Wall, when everything seemed very fluid and also very uncertain, I tried to put an emphasis on what I call the work of the imagination. And I tried to say that the imagination was a vital force in social life, that it was much more than its, it meant much more than its force in individual, personal, say, artistic life, where we know the imagination is the key to what is produced or performed or painted or sculpted or danced. But I wanted to say that the imagination is actually everywhere in social life, and that all people at all times use their imaginations, and furthermore, they use their imaginations in a collective way, not only in their own thinking. So if you take, for example, a lot of work in anthropology over 100 or 150 years among small societies, low technology societies, which used to be called primitive societies, far away, etc., many people noticed, many ethnographers, many field workers, that all over the world, people had and discussed their dreams. Now, Freud, as you recall, used the important phrase in its German original, of course, the idea of dream work or Arbeit. So this idea of dream work is everybody's work, and it's a collective work. And in most societies in which people have dreams, discuss dreams, those dreams have a collective shape. They are rarely arbitrary. They're usually grounded in some kind of cosmology, some kind of idea of what are the social tensions, which might be about kinship, about family, about ecology, about anything else. But dreams are rarely, in any society, arbitrary. So that's one example. But if you think about the intellectual side of any society of which we have information in the past or the present, the imagination is everywhere. Art certainly is everywhere. Dreams are everywhere. More important still, myths, cosmology is everywhere. And some of the great cosmologies of the world emerge, as we know, from societies that are technologically extremely simple. So I'll give you only one example, which is Australian Aboriginal society. Until the impact of colonizers from England in Australia, was an extraordinarily simple technological society, but a society of unimaginable cosmological complexity. So that even the kinship systems of native Australians, indigenous Australians, for those of you who have studied maybe a bit of kinship in anthropology, are extraordinarily complex. They're still being puzzled over by anthropologists who have a great deal of sophistication in language, in linguistics, in structuralism, even in mathematics. And these sectional systems in which relatives are divided in a very complicated way between those who are marriageable and those who are not, etc., are really very, very intricate. The same is true for Aboriginal ritual, for Aboriginal pictures of the landscape, for Aboriginal art, which some of you have doubtless seen in its modern forms, which anticipate powerfully movements like minimalism, for example, or pointillism, and so on and so forth. Now, these things don't just happen. They're all fruits of the imagination, and that too, the imagination not just as an abstract human capacity, but as something culturally formed and socially sustained. I won't say a lot more at the moment about the imagination as one element of the future as a cultural fact. But it's a crucial one. It must be kept in mind because otherwise we tend to forget, first, that the imagination is not just individual, as I said. It is not just private. It's also public, social, collective. And second, that it's also highly specific. And this is one of the great lessons of the history of anthropology is whenever you look at a cosmology from Australia, from Hawaii, from somewhere in Africa, it's very rich and usually very specific, very particular. Now, of course, in the world of globalization, these products of the imagination are in constant interaction, so they're no longer as pristine, separate, clear, and independent as they used to be. But nevertheless, there is difference everywhere we look. It's just that there's much more contact, much more flow, much more interaction, but it's interaction among cosmologies and values and ideas, even fantasies, which are historically highly particular. So I'll say no more at the moment about the imagination, but go on to say a few things about aspiration. I will note that we need a general recuperation of the traces of the imagination in the anthropological and sociological record as one vital element in building a robust anthropology of the future, which is really my larger aim. Let me go on now to talk about the second element, aspiration. And that is very central to my talk and much more directly connected to my own research over the last 10 years or so, particularly in my home city, Mumbai, but also in some other cities in Africa and elsewhere in Asia, among urban slum dwellers, very poor residents of the world's big cities. I have been doing this research for about 10 years and working with a particular network of activists who work among slum dwellers, who are globally networked, and whose primary concern is housing. Now, when I began this study, by the way, this is just a side comment, I had no knowledge either about cities or about slums or about housing. And for an anthropologist, housing, you know, seems not like the most thrilling subject in the world. It seems like a sociological or urban planning subject. You know, well, there's housing and there's not housing and we have to build social housing, etc. It, however, turns out, and I've certainly discovered this, that housing, shelter, is one of the most serious problems in the world today. That is, people who do not have what the activists call secure housing. That is, housing that is reliable, where you are allowed to stay in the house and are not kicked out tomorrow. You would be shocked, I'm sure, most of you, I certainly was, to discover how many hundreds of thousands of people on a regular basis are removed from their housing throughout the world, even and up to and including the world of Europe and the US, but particularly in places like Africa, India, China, much of the Middle East, and so on. One small example is in China during the recent Olympics, vast numbers of people were just cleared out from Beijing. Where did they go? What happened to them? No one knows. But huge spaces were cleared out of people, usually migrants to the city, who don't have full human rights in China, were just simply cleared away, moved to other remote places and so on. But this goes on the world over all the time, in the hundreds of thousands. So think of it this way, that every person who is for any reason, a refugee, for example, created by war or created by something else, is in fact also a homeless person. So once you think about it that way, the numbers that are homeless or at risk of being homeless is extremely high, and housing is a lens into that form of human insecurity. So let me then talk about aspiration among these very poor urban populations, people who belong to what Mike Davis called the planet of slums. Hope and its politics and ethics now play an increasingly prominent part in philosophy and progressive social science. Ernst Bloch's grand work on hope marked a transition in European social thought from a preoccupation with utopias, radical revolution, and millennial change to more nuanced engagement with hope as a feature of everyday social life and of the conditions for its cultivation. In some sense, the grand recent work of Hart and Negri on the multitude is an effort to sketch the conditions for the global politics of hope, as also the work of, say, David Harvey, coming from Marxist critical geography. And there are many other people who belong to this discussion, such as Agamben, Zizek, Levinas, all in very different ways concerned with where is hope produced in human life and how can we enrich or cultivate those spaces and sources. So in a recent article on this housing movement, I gave the article the title, The Capacity to Aspire. So aspiration, I wanted to argue, and I did argue in that paper, is a human capacity, like thinking, like feeling, like loving, like conversing, aspiring. And aspiration, somebody pointed out to me, is both the word that relates to hope, but it's also the hope that a word that relates to breathing, aspiration. It's literally the breath of life. And people throughout the world, in this article, what I argue is that poverty is not only a matter of material deficit, not enough housing, not enough food, not enough shelter, not enough healthcare, and so on, not enough employment for sure. But it's also a bad or maldistribution of the very capacity to aspire. So one of the measures, I argue, of poverty, not just a symptom, but an actual measure, is the bad distribution of the capacity to hope. Because what poverty does is not only to diminish your material resources, but also to diminish the horizon of your thinking, your capacity to imagine an alternative future. In other words, the capacity to aspire, meaning not just hope for the best in an abstract way, but aspire to specific changes in your future, in your housing, in your work, for your children, in education, and so forth. That capacity itself is unequally distributed. And I believe that that is one of the primary measures of poverty. And of course, one of our great challenges is to examine the relationship between those two kinds of inequality or poverty. So recently, in the last 5 to 8 years, some of you will know that there's been a vigorous debate between my New York colleague, Nancy Fraser, and the German social theorist, sociologist, philosopher, Alex Honneth, on the relation between redistribution, which is a more material political reality, and recognition, the idea that comes from Charles Taylor, who is going to be speaking in this series, great thinker. But the question is, what is the relationship? Can we just correct the problem of recognition and material redistribution will follow? Maybe. Or can we do the reverse, something more in the spirit of Marx? Change the material arrangements and the rest will follow. Well, I think today we suspect that we cannot choose that way. We have to look at the very relationship between recognition and redistribution. And I, in my thoughts on the capacity to aspire, on the unequal distribution of the capacity to aspire, have argued that the capacity to aspire is the capacity which mediates between material inequality and inequality in the very creation of horizons for the future, that they are in a kind of mutually shaping dialectic, and that we need to look aspiration as a capacity whose distribution needs to be changed by some direct means. I also argue there, and I just repeat this today, that the capacity to aspire, which means to imagine a better life for yourself, your family, your group, your community, is a cultural capacity. And this connects to the idea that the future is not just an abstraction, universal, flat, even, but is variable, is culturally specific. I think the capacity to aspire is in this sense a cultural capacity. And I want to say a few words now about why I believe that. I think one way to look at the capacity to aspire as a cultural capacity is by examining the significance of ideas of the good life in different societies. It is true that today, as a consequence of the widespread impact of global media, the speed of cyber communication, and the multiplication of travel circuits, ranging from sex tourism and humanitarian intervention to foreign wars and labor migration, there is a general growth in shared images of the good life, some commercial and wealth-centered, as evidenced in the rush to, for example, trade in stocks, the stock market, among Japanese housewives, for example, and Chinese men, big, very large activity, recent. And others are more political, such as the global growth in popular ideas of democracy, even in places as isolated as Burma and Nepal, close to the part of the world that I come from. Yet these global convergences in the search for prosperity, mobility, and voice still take their force from configurations of value, ethics, and religion that are strikingly local and variable. These configurations can be looked at in the variety of images of the good life that still characterize our world. An obvious case, one case, of this specificity is the world of evangelical Christianity in the US. For all its bewildering internal variety, it assembles a specific constellation of meaning surrounding the very idea of life, the afterlife, the Christian life, and the virtuous life. Today, especially in those sectors of the world, of this world, that are heavily mediated through television and radio in the US, there is a specific combination of values and messages that saturates the Christian fundamentalist world and tends to emphasize a form of salvific self-help, a healthy dose of commercial enterprise, a powerful stress on the bearing of witness to those who are not saved, a strong tendency to enter debates on creation, abortion, and other scientific fields, and a long-standing bias towards the family, family values, as you know, as a moral oasis against the threats of homosexuality, divorce, and sexual freedom. At the same time, this evangelical world has a strong missionizing dimension, and through such organizations, various Christian organizations of mercy, has become deeply embedded in the world of transnational humanitarianism, especially in the context of worldwide natural disasters. The tsunami, for example, the oil spill, Katrina, numerous other examples. The vision of the good life that underpins this worldview is Christian in a highly specific American way, in which politics, commerce, and science are co-articulated into a highly particular image of what the Christian good life is about. This conception of the good life is necessarily connected to the highly specific picture of the afterlife, with the figure and person of Jesus as the central ethical presence that both redeems and represents life in the here and now. So I'm simply giving this little quick example of the evangelical world in the US to say it's not merely Christian, it's very particularly American, And after that, it might be highly varied inside. But it's not a world one would immediately recognize, I don't think, in Germany, for example, and in France, where it's not necessarily right to life, which is the forming feature of Christian evangelical thought. Now, why that should be is, of course, an interesting question, but it's clear. It's rather specific. And there are other quite specific things that are, as it were, made in America. This conception of the Christian good life is, of course, full of internal debates and variations, as is the case, I take another one, in the Islamic world, which also contains a rich variety of ideas of the good life, which have largely been represented in the West through the lens of terror, jihad, and suicide bombing. In fact, of course, this is a rather thin view of the Muslim sense of the good life, which combines a rather different picture of the relationship of authority to community, of commerce and profit to social values, and of solidarity and political warfare to self-reform. As people often say, jihad is not about war, it is the constant war with oneself. Many thinkers have shown that, for example, my colleague Faisal Devji, that if you look at the ideology and the written philosophy, say, of Al-Qaeda, it's very clear that they speak a language of humanity, and humanitarianism. That is, they don't say, you people have all these things, we have something else, and we want it. They say, no, you have failed in all this. We speak for humanity. And if you read the writings of al-Zawahiri and even some writings of Osama bin Laden, they're very self-conscious, for example, about nuclear war as the very beginning of the idea of humanity as a species, because for the first time, humanity could be destroyed totally. So these are people who are aware of something which, in our own tradition, the first person to identify this idea, that the idea of humanity begins only after the possibility of nuclear Armageddon, is Hannah Arendt. But that's one tradition. But in this radical Islamic thought, also there's an idea about humanity, humanitarianism, human intervention, and so on and so forth. It's not the same necessarily as ours, but it is an idea. So these ideas about humanity and humanism may well represent a powerful metaphysics of the virtuous Muslim life and afterlife. But this does not prevent them from speaking in the idiom of a certain brand of modernist humanitarianism about suffering, justice, human rights, and human welfare. Yet, the languages of the good life in Islam, with its many variations across the Shia, Sunni, Ismaili worlds, and across the range of social classes, from the slums of Cairo to the courts of the Persian Gulf, are marked by their own brands of sexual puritanism, religious fervor, and political aggressiveness. Now, I've given you two examples, US Christian evangelical world and some parts of the Islamic world. These examples, I believe, of the good life and therefore of the capacity to aspire. Because what do people aspire to? They aspire to the good life. The question is, what's inside it? What is the idea of the good life? And that is what I think in a lot of our thinking we tend to take for granted. Well, the good life means being healthy, wealthy, and wise, or at least healthy and wealthy. But the reality is the good life is as varied as marriage, kinship, dreaming, etc., and we don't know a great deal about it. So all societies contain traditions of messianism, millennialism, and radical change. And in the era of globalization, these have begun to produce unusual new foci of cultural conflict and ethical adventurism, as we witnessed a couple of years ago in the crisis of a group of South Korean Protestant missionaries in Afghanistan, which has highlighted the rising importance of South Korea as a Protestant missionizing force, second only to the United States in various Asian societies and beyond. This is a kind of little fact, but it's kind of rather huge in Asia. If you say, what's going on in Korea? Well, North Korea is going on, but meanwhile, every day, there are thousands of South Koreans missionizing in the name of Protestantism throughout Asia. Furthermore, there are Protestant missionaries, I'll just add this another little fact, from mainland China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, who are missionizing in England right now, being studied by my colleague Peter van der Veer and others at the Max Planck, New Max Planck Institute in Göttingen. So there are all these interesting mixtures. And anthropology has a fairly strong record in the study of various forms of millennial eruption. But I think we need to do more than just look at millennialism or turn of the millennium kind of ecstatic movements and so on. We need to look more broadly. Another way in which to make the case for aspiration, which is what I've been talking about so far, the capacity to aspire, as a critical piece of the future, as a cultural fact, is to say that hope is the political counterpart to the work of the imagination. So you can imagine a great deal, but aspiration begins to direct that force towards some reality of the good life. For it is only through some sort of politics of hope that any society or group can envisage a journey to desirable change in the state of things. It might be true that in some sort of abstract typology, there are, or there may be, hot and cold societies, in Levi-Strauss's famous distinction, societies which engage or deny change. But in the world we live in today, it seems difficult to assert that any society or social group is entirely satisfied with the state of things, and that any society has dispensed with the need for a politics of hope. Yet imagination and aspiration, both of which can be shown to be everywhere features of the work of culture, in other words, that they are cultural facts, are intimately connected with the third faculty that I'm going to discuss, the faculty of anticipation, which has in some ways been given the greatest amount of play in the archive of anthropology. So let me discuss anticipation, my third element. So first imagination, second aspiration, now anticipation. All things that I think we need to look at as elements of the future as a cultural fact, meaning as a variable historical fact, not just an abstraction. So this discussion will be of anticipation, risk, and speculation. And it brings me into the study of today's global economy, which is, of course, on our minds and in the news every day. In a sense, the good life may be characterized as what, in any society, many people hope to achieve. Yet, as I have suggested, anthropology has more been concerned with what people fear rather than what they want or wish. So there is a tradition, and I'm not going to speak much about it. It involves people like Evans Pritchard, Mary Douglas, many other distinguished people who have talked about practices like divination, sorcery, etc., all of which, astrology, things which involve some kind of effort to guess what's going to happen. Usually, it is to say, if you do not do this, that bad thing will happen, so you must perform this kind of ritual to avoid that kind of outcome, etc. Now, that's a very short and very simple way to characterize a very rich body of anthropological work. And this work also extends to the great tradition of sociology, for example, to Max Weber, whose work I'm very interested in now and was very early in my career as well, who in his life work on the history of capitalism made a profound distinction between magic and religion. And magic for him was mainly this effort to figure out what's going to happen and try and control it. Religion was about ethics, values, salvation, but magic was about trying to fiddle with the wiring in some way favorable to oneself. But it's a very widespread view. So today, happily, in anthropology, sociology, and so on, as some of you may know, this deficit in studying, let's say, risk, anticipation, etc., not only as, if you like, magical techniques, but as somewhat more complex than that, is being addressed by people studying, for example, modern monetary forms, stock exchanges, new financial instruments, gambling as a game and lifestyle, and related risk-based phenomena of modern life. And of course, one of the great students of risk society is in Germany, my friend and colleague Ulrich Beck. And he is in a discussion involving earlier people like May Douglas, Giddens, and so on, all aware that risk is a very complex institutionalized feature of modern life. So there's very interesting work in this area, but I think even more could be done. This body of inquiries into risk as a managed feature of contemporary life fits into a broader tradition of culturally oriented work on emergent neoliberal forms of capitalism, including what is sometimes called millennial capitalism, casino capitalism, disaster capitalism, about which I'm going to speak in a second, and either other highly specific forms of risk making and risk taking, which connect the study of modern markets to other dimensions of speculation, crisis, and value in contemporary life. And here I am also working, and I won't say a lot about this, on a distinction which is, I think, relevant when we are thinking about risk in modern life, between what we may call the ethics of possibility and the ethics of probability. Now, among other people, this has been touched on by people like Zygmunt Bauman. And the distinction is roughly along the same lines. The ethics of possibility for me is what I am positively interested in, where it's related closely to hope, to what could happen, how we might produce the conditions of the good life as we imagine it. The ethics of probability, and I use the word ethics advisedly, is what tends to engulf us from the outside. It's what Ian Hacking calls the avalanche of numbers. Insurance, stock markets, health statistics, and so on. These are the things with which ordinary people are normally assaulted. And it has probability, which is very characteristic of the whole world of finance, of the whole world of health management, of the substantial parts of the world of politics, marketing, survey research. All this is large numbers. Lots of numbers, and numbers to which probabilities are attached. The number of people, women between the ages of 30 and 50, likely to contract breast cancer is X. That's just a fact in your face with lots and lots of details available. I'm not talking about whether it's true, false, or whatever, but it's not anything to do with your idea of the good life. It's just something imposed on you, usually for actuarial, commercial, political, managerial reasons. It's not about the horizon of possibility, the way I would like to see it. So if we think this way, by the ethics of possibility, I mean those ways of thinking, feeling, and acting which increase the horizons of hope, that expand the field of the imagination, that produce greater equity in what I just called the capacity to aspire, and that widen the field of informed, creative, and critical citizenship. So this is what I'm on the side of. So I'm not neutral in relating to these two ethics. This ethics is part and parcel of transnational civil society movements, progressive democratic organizations, and in general, the politics of hope. As I said, by the ethics of probability, I mean really something else, the avalanche of numbers, and to some extent what Foucault saw as the capillary dangers of modern regimes of diagnosis, counting, and accounting, the average man, etc., which are very recent concepts that arise in the link between statistics, governmentality, and markets, and so on. Very recent, very specialized. I do believe, again as a side point, which I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, that while there are many debates going on, as we all know, about globalization, and different debates in different parts of the world, I think across and underneath many of them, there is a kind of tectonic struggle between the ethics of possibility and the ethics of probability. And I want to discuss two recent essays that struck me a lot. They came out actually just before the global meltdown, the huge financial meltdown of the last 2 years. These both appeared in October and November 2007, so before the meltdown was fully on us, but post-Katrina and so on. I bring them up now because they pertain to the problem of anticipation. One is the book that many of you probably have read, although my own thoughts come from an article by her, by Naomi Klein on disaster capitalism, which already seems like an ancient book, but it's only 2 years old or 2.5 years old, but it's before the meltdown, BM, so to speak, but very prescient. And I'll just remind you of what Naomi Klein basically says in that book, though it's been debated a lot, but it's a rather scary point, which is that while historically the capitalist apparatus always profited from war, now the capitalist apparatus actually produces and predicts and manages disaster in advance in order to produce huge profits. And she has tremendous evidence from particularly the decade after the year 2000, but also in the 90s. This is what she calls, by the way, disaster capitalism, is that you actually project where disaster is going to occur and then speculate on it. You don't do that after the disaster has occurred and say, well, let's make money out of the war. You actually produce economic and other kinds of disasters, and she has impressive information of a variety of kinds, some of it from the US adventure in Iraq, where, as you may recall, after George Bush Jr. launched Shock and Awe, within 2 weeks, Halliburton and company were on the ground rebuilding. Literally, there is no way that this could have been an open process where people said, well, what should we do in Iraq? They were there instantly. First Shock and Awe, boom, next construction companies. She goes on at some length. And I remember I wrote a small piece, unfortunately I never published it, but the only worthy thing in it was the title, which I referred to as Weapons of Mass Construction. In other words, this is what our biggest US industries do, is of course, you know, and Joseph Schumpeter saw this very early, the great economist, when he spoke of creative destruction, an idea that's also a little bit in Marx, that capitalism, you must destroy, otherwise what are you going to build? And this is true of urban development, it's true of many, many things. But in the US now, we see this clearly, that disaster, Katrina is another case, that these things are increasingly predicted and even produced. And some of you may know the shocking fact that there's always a serious effort now in the US speculative markets, hedging and so on, which we know a lot about these days, far too much, unfortunately, to avoid the thing, of course, that many people would really love to do, which is to have potential speculation and betting on the next terrorist attack. Because, of course, once you have the betting, the risk of encouraging it at a particular time or place in order to make good on your bet increases. So far, that's not allowed in the US and Europe and so on. But everything edges towards betting on the short side. And actually in some other work that I'm doing right now on the financial crisis, trying to bring back some ideas of Max Weber and so on, I believe the people to look at in this mega global financial crisis are the so-called bears, the short sellers, the people who will tell you market is going to go down. Everybody says, no, 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 housing is going to go up, up, up. There are a handful of guys who say it's going to go down. Furthermore, I know when it's going to go down, and they make billions. John Paulson, a name you've probably seen in the US, biggest hedge fund manager, made several billion in one day when the housing market went down. Why? He bet on the move down, and he bet on when. Everybody knows it's going to go down someday, but the next century doesn't make you money. You have to save within 2.5 years because you're paying insurance premiums along the way. So if you pay insurance premiums for 30 years, you lose, lose, lose. But when the market goes down, in 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, you make untold billion. So it's betting on the downside. So I make this argument, and I'll cite one other lovely essay, which is by a man who's also a very popular author on the current financial crisis. His name is Michael Lewis. He has a book called The Big Short. He's written a lot on Wall Street, one of the best, most brilliant, persuasive, fluent authors on the financial crisis today. He wrote a little essay in 2007, before the meltdown, in which he discussed a very arcane group of mathematicians who work very closely with the financial world, so arcane that I can't fully represent their mathematics to you, but I can tell you that the mathematics is based on predicting very low frequency events. So if there's an event like a massive hurricane, this is the Katrina story, which will happen only once every 500 years, but it will happen. How do you over centuries predict that distribution of highly unlikely events and then create instruments for monetizing that prediction? The name for that is the one I love, and it relates to the Naomi Klein point, is catastrophe bonds, cat bonds for short. So it's a very arcane mathematical thing. This is the ethics of probability. In other words, that you have mathematical devices that allow you to give some probability to very low frequency events, and then monetize that probability and allow people to bet on possible outcomes. For example, hurricanes in the southwest, south of the US. And again, huge monies can be made out of this, and that's part of what informs the whole hedge fund world. Now, why do I go into this particular analysis of the economy? I do this to say that in the study of the of anticipation as a cultural horizon, we need to understand more about how anticipation is a cultural faculty so that we don't hand over our capacity to anticipate entirely to the world of catastrophe bonds and disaster capitalism. That is, the people who are professionally sitting in little rooms studying numbers and distributions so that they can be turned into instruments on which we can speculate, usually at our cost. That is the cost of the ordinary investor or the small investor, as you say. So we need to reclaim some of that space, and it's very important to understand what is happening on the other side so that we can re-articulate other ways of looking forward or anticipating the future so that there is some opposition, some creative opposition to the forces of commercial speculation. Very naked, very cynical. So if somebody is able to bet and make billions on the fact that hundreds of thousands of ordinary Americans are going to lose their houses, you have to have a particular ethics to do that and to say, well, I'm not creating the damage. You all think it's going to go up and up and up. I believe it's going to go down, and here are my reasons, and here's the money I'm going to mint legally. Now, the question is, who made the deal for you? Who sold you the insurance? This is the Goldman Sachs problem, but I won't go into that. So it's not as clean as it looks, but on the face of it, it's a legal business. So my question is, easily said, but when the law is owned, it's difficult. But I hope this will come up in the question and answers. Question is also, you can change the law is a good point, but I think also we need to reclaim the terrain of non-expert ways to anticipate the future, which have been pushed out of all our thought. So all we have is these actuarial speculative apparatuses through which to handle it. So let me conclude with a few thoughts summarizing what I've said so far and also saying a few words about the way ahead, or because I know that's part of the spirit of this seminar, is the question, what next, I believe. As a quick summary, I've tried to say that anthropology and related fields have failed to give us a good idea of how the future is a culturally organized thing. If I tell you history and memory are culturally organized, you won't have much debate with that. It's not that all of us are Hegelians with a universal history. We have this history, that history of Germany, history of France, history of Berlin, history of my neighborhood, and so on. But regarding the future, we tend to think of it a bit of an empty canvas, you know, a kind of universalist empty plate. Everybody wants the same things. Well, it's not at all clear. I've tried to show you that. So to take that seriously, I've suggested we need to look at the imagination as a social activity, at aspiration as a political but unequal capacity which needs to be developed among those who need it most. The urban poor is my most immediate example for me. And finally, we need to cultivate the resources for anticipation on behalf of the ethics of possibility rather than of probability. I'm sure there are other things that are required to study the future as a cultural fact, but these three things I think certainly are important. And I think they may play a role, and this is what allows me to just suggest one among many, many paths forward is a dialogue that we need in order, a dialogue in which this kind of cultural interest can come into some interaction with the world of design and of planning, which is normally a very separate world from the world of social and cultural criticism. And my argument here, which I'll put very simply, is that designing and planning are often seen in terms of designing particular objects, designing this microphone, for example, or at a very big scale, designing this building. Even bigger scale, designing this city, which sometimes people have the chance to do. Not always, they can only redesign parts. But Brasilia, other places, built from scratch. What I would like to say is that the great challenge is not so much designing things, though that can be very challenging, but designing context. That is the context in which the thing is going to function. The mic is going to function, my food is going to function, my clothing is going to function, my housing is going to function. Designing context is very difficult because contexts are the thing that surround the things, but they're not so material. In a way, it's like saying your project is to design the nothing, which is between two somethings, two houses, two clothes, two suits, or think of your whole house as filled with things, but what is the stuff between the things? There's something there. You might call it space, you might call it your life, really. For design, that is a very big challenge, and the thing that allows me to bring up what looks like a separate topic in relation to the future as a cultural horizon is to say that part, I think, of the value in thinking about the future in these highly specific ways is that it might allow us to design contexts which are more friendly to the future as a cultural fact. That is, ideas of the good life which are local and which are specific. Not by local, of course, I don't mean cut off from the global, but I mean still specific, particular. Capacities to imagine, to aspire, to anticipate, these all have to arise in life as it is lived. And life as it is lived can be seen as just something given, something about which we can do nothing, or we can say it is capable of being redesigned. And certainly people in planning and design, professionals in these fields, certainly are trying to do that with housing, with clothing, with technology, and so on and so forth. But I'm saying what we need also is something a little more tricky, which is the capacity to design context in which all these objects will circulate. And to design context for the future, I think it's very difficult to make any progress unless we study more the range of futures, plural, which are culturally designed and which exist on the ground and in which people display to us, ordinary people, their capacities already to imagine, to aspire, and to anticipate. And I'll end by just commenting that the very poor, often illiterate, often women with whom I have worked in the slums of Mumbai, who are often living in the pavement like this. Here's the house, here's the pavement, and this is the house. hundreds, thousands. Bombay probably has conservatively 400,000 or 500,000 people living on the pavement, and many, many more, millions living in very bad housing. But on the pavement, certainly 500,000 or more. That's a very, very big number, very big number. But those individuals, especially when they have been touched by some kind of social activism, some kind of stimulation, and that's what I'm studying, is how do these activists create this energy, do show tremendous capacities to articulate, to voice, to express their visions of the good life. And by studying those things, one begins to get, at least I have begun to get, some of the material for how we can, as it were, better design context for the future, and how one can also see in what is around one, even in very poor, very marginalized, often desperately poor populations, the grounds for the politics of hope. And people that I talk to often say to me, you know, talking about housing or about urban poverty or about slums in India or Africa, somebody say, well, you know, well, given all these terrible, harsh realities, are you hopeful about what could happen? And my answer to them, which is my concluding comment to you, is if these people are themselves hopeful, I have no right to be hopeless or pessimistic. So on that score, I'll, with that comment, conclude. Thank you very, very much.